Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Office Hours. I'm your host, Daniel Fink. Thanks for joining us. All right, so here's how Office Hours works. Explain to you how Office Hours works here. On each program, we open the phone lines for an hour, and I, accompanied by a guest, will take your questions. Questions about work, about business, about life, about anything you want. If you have questions, we'll have answers. And when we don't have answers, we will make something up. Now, as for this, our very first episode, I'm delighted to introduce our special guest, the remarkable, the redoubtable, the inimitable, Seth Godin. Hi, Seth.
I was told that this was an NPR thing and that Click and Clack were going to be here, and I'm a little miffed.
Yeah, well, you know what? You and I are basically the poor man's Click and Clack, so that's what we're going to try to do. Now, I want to introduce you, Seth, to the three people out there in Radio Land who don't know who you are. So here's a brief introduction of my friend Seth. Seth, again, everybody knows you, but just for the one or two of you, maybe the guy from Sweden I see who's called in, Seth writes the most popular marketing blog in the world. He's written 13 books, all of them bestsellers. He founded Squidoo and the Domino Project. And he's introduced more memes into the cultural bloodstream than anyone I can think of. Permission marketing, purple cows, building your tribe. He is one of the most creative people I know, as well as the most relentlessly productive. And if that weren't annoying enough, he's also a nice guy. So, Seth, welcome to Office Hours. You ready to take some questions?
I'm thrilled. Anything I can do with Dan Pink is high on my list. I'm ready for questions.
Yes, and what Seth lacked in talent, he made up for in availability here. So he was available at 1 o'clock today. So we're glad to have him here. No, but he is, as all the callers know, this unbelievably and irritatingly creative. And so I'm hoping that he'll be able to apply his creativity to your questions here. Now, folks, here's how it works. If you want to ask a question out there in Radio Land or quasi-Radio Land as it is right now, what you need to do is press *2. *2, that will allow our crack team of producers to see you on the control panel. And Seth, I'm so happy because for the first time in my life, I have a control panel. So I'm very, very excited. I'll say your name, Fred, like something like Fred in St. Louis, you're on the air, and you can ask away. Now I see some people already hitting *2, getting ready to ask their questions. So that's fantastic. Remember, just hit *2, and then what I will do is I'll say your name. I think we're going to go to somebody, well, we'll see. I'll say your name, like Fred in St. Louis, you're on the air, and you can ask away. If you're at the website, you can also go to the box at the left-hand side of your screen where it says submit your question. You can type those in, and we'll try to get to your question if we can. But before we begin, let's just talk very briefly to Seth, because I think that listener Seth would like to hear about your latest project. Tell us about your latest project. Not only what you did the new piece this week, but also how that fits into the context of what you're doing.
Well, you know, the problem of writing about the way the world is changing is it's super easy to become a hypocrite. And for years and years, I was writing about the death of traditional book publishing. And then once a year, I was writing a contract with a traditional book publisher where they would pay me to do a book in a way that I was predicting was going to go away. So last year, I decided to stop being a hypocrite and announced that I was done publishing books the traditional way. A couple weeks later, my friends at Amazon contacted me. I had been in their face 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, saying you guys should become publishers. And they said, we don't want to be publishers, but we will power a publishing company if you run it. So I started a publishing company called the Domino Project, and our stated goal is to blow things up, invent things, poke, fail, and hopefully have our ideas stolen by the very good people in book publishing that I like so that book publishing can remain as vibrant as it is. So our second book came out 2 days ago. We now have 2 books in the top 6 on the Kindle, free. They're the number 1 and number 2 best-selling free nonfiction books on the Kindle.
Those would be poke the box and do something?
Well, no. The new one is called Do the Work. And
it's by
Steve Pressfield. You can get it in hardcover where it's already a bestseller. It's a short book, and you can get it on the Kindle for free. I believe that when the price of digital books has a marginal cost of zero, because you can deliver another one for nothing, then like the web, it's pretty inevitable that it's going to be ad-supported, not purchase-supported, but we'll see how that works. And the book, my book that came out 4 weeks ago, is called Poke the Box, and that book is the fastest-selling book I've ever done, which I think is pretty cool. And that one's not available for free. The other one that we have that's available for free right now is the sequel to Poke the Box. We came out with the sequel 4 weeks after the original. The sequel is written by 1,000 of my readers. They all contributed their own stories about how they had poked the box, and then we posted them and let readers vote. And we took the 100 top vote-getters and assembled them in an anthology called Tales of the Revolution.
Wow, sequel 4 weeks later. Outstanding. That is a metabolism that the publishing industry has never, ever seen, or at least the book publishing industry has never, ever seen. But, Seth, you erred a little bit when you said that Poke the Box is no longer free, because here on Office Hours, it actually is. We've been giving away 52 copies of Seth's latest book, Poke the Box, in a random drawing of people who registered for the program. So for some lucky 52 people who have taken time out of their day to listen in, Seth, they're going to get a free copy, a free Adams copy, you know.
Molecular.
And all that kind of stuff. So that's good. All right, folks, so remember, we're going to go to the phones and take some questions. Here's how you ask a question. Again, press *2. What that will do is that will allow our crack team of producers here at Pink Ink World Headquarters, which is, of course, my backyard, to see that you have a question that you would like to ask, and then I will say your name and you'll ask the question. We're going to try this out here. Who will be the Neil Armstrong of Office Hours? The first person to take one bold step across this mysterious and majestic landscape. I don't know where he's from, but he's first in line. I'd like you to tell me where you're from. Let's go to Simon Harvey. Simon, where are you?
I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Charlottesville, Virginia, all the way from the mean streets of Charlottesville, home of UVA, University of Virginia.
Oh, yeah, go Hoos.
Simon, what is your question?
Well, actually, I don't have a question because I hooked on. I just heard you say push *2, so I did. So.
All right, Simon.
I jumped the gun.
This probably happened on the moon landing, where Neil Armstrong was probably not the first person to walk on the moon. It was probably some other guy who fell down the steps or something, and history never recorded that. So, Simon, we're going to pretend like this never happened, unless you do have a question.
No, I'm sure I will later, but you just crank on there.
Okay, Simon, thanks so much. That was really great. What an auspicious way to start. Thank you, Simon. All right, remind me not to take any calls from Charlottesville again. Maybe we could do... Well, there you go. Now, this is what Seth would call poking the box. I poked the box and came up with Simon, which is one of the dangers of poking the box.
You just send him a book, though, for sure.
It's a random drawing for the book. I can't change the rules now.
You don't think that was random, what he did?
Let's go to Mary Beth in what looks to be Orleans, Massachusetts. Mary Beth, are you on the line? Mary Beth in Orleans, Mass., are you on the line?
Turn down your radio, please, Mary Beth.
Okay, there we go. So far we're 0-2. Let's try another one here. We're going to stay on the American East Coast, even though that seems perilous. Let's go to Stacy in Asheville, North Carolina. Stacy, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm actually on the line, and I have a question.
Hallelujah, Stacy! Congratulations on being the first successful participant in Office Hours. Not the first, you're actually the third. But thank you. Stacy, what's your question for me or Seth? About anything, remember, Stacy, we are the click and clack of the human engine. What's your question?
Well, I am a big fan of your book, Dan, Love Drive, but I am actually going to pose this question, I think, mostly to Seth. Seth's also a huge fan, of course, of your books. I think most particularly The Dip actually really spoke to me most recently and helped me to quit my my hospital job. I'm a nurse midwife, and I've been working in a hospital system for 13 years. And about 2 years ago, I launched my personal coaching business called Midwife for Your Life. And so I launched that in June of 2009, and it's steadily gaining traction. What I would like to hear from you is what would be your advice to someone who's looking to get their ideal clients to be better referrers? I have, my clients love me, but they are primarily moms, in their late 40s who have always, devoted all their energy and really the money to their kids. And now their kids are growing up, they're getting out of the house, and they finally have some expendable income that they are investing in themselves through coaching with me. But
okay,
they have
so
that.
The question is, how do you get your clients to spread the word about your awesomeness? Is that pretty much it?
Exactly, but the little bit of the rub is, it's just that they,
Okay, well, I was talking about you last week with Steve Dubner, the Freakonomics guy on the radio, because we were talking about the dip, and he said, well, that may be working for people like you and me, but what about someone, I don't know, like a nurse? And so I told your story without actually having been informed in advance that you existed. And I'm really pleased that you're making this leap. Here's what the problem is. The problem is that certain things we like to talk about, like where we got our hair cut and where that tattoo came from, but other things we don't, like where did you go for therapy, or that's a nice massage, where did you get it? And as a result, certain endeavors grow faster than others because they lend themselves to these conversations. I think the challenge is not to try to change human nature and get people to talk about something they might feel uncomfortable talking about. I think the opportunity is to change part of the service that you offer and to be able to go to your clients and say, if you'd like, I would be happy to run a roundtable conversation for 6 of your best friends. If you buy the coffee cake, I'll come at no cost. Now this person has this opportunity to do something generous for her friends, which is not host a sales pitch by you, but for you to host a different kind of counseling or coaching or conversation that works better when there's 6 people in the room. And so now this woman doesn't have to be embarrassed. She can say, I'm doing a favor for my best friends, which is we're going to have this really exciting forward-moving conversation. I don't have to charge them anything. All I have to do is buy an Entenmann's. And you can experiment about how you structure that, but there's a long history all the way back to Zig Ziglar of people liking to invite their friends over if that conversation is going to benefit everyone.
Great. Oh, that's perfect. Thank you. Because it was the self-consciousness about working with me, you know, spending that money on themselves, that was the rub. But like you said, I mean, they love to help their friends, and I could see that working perfectly. Thank you so much. I really
appreciate
it. Stacey, thanks for your call. It's a great question and a brilliant answer from Seth. It's a really good point, Seth, that you make about about certain businesses not being as word-of-mouth friendly. The where did you get that massage versus something people can see or hear or touch. How do you think that breaks out? I mean, do you think most of us have businesses that are inherently spreadable? Or do you think most of us have businesses that are harder to spread?
Well, you know, you've written a lot about how the brain works, and I don't think we've identified the part of the brain that wants to gab and blab, but it's there. And, you know, what Dave Balter at Buzz Agent figured out is people like to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
And the magic for businesses is this. Go into a business that people traditionally haven't spoken about and change it so that they do speak about it. And when you make that occur, that's where value is created. So no one used to talk about what kind of phone they had. And then someone invented the ringtone. And the ringtone was a magical transformation because it made the phone into a social object. And then Steve Jobs took that 1,000 times further and turned the phone itself into a social object. The problem with going into businesses that have a history of people talking about them is that it's much harder to get more than your fair share. That, you know, if you go into the hairdressing business, because it's so easy to get into that business, you're never going to be able to get adequately compensated. But if you go into a business where traditionally people don't talk about it. And I'll use an example of a real estate broker. But you act in a way that no real estate broker has acted in the past, in a way that causes it to become remarkable, then you can make unseemly profits.
And also make a difference in people's lives, although I'm all for unseemly profits, believe me.
I forgot which show I was on. I'm sorry.
Yes, this is not
make a different show, not the unseemly profits.
This is actually a show about making something. Making a profit, making some noise. And let's make some noise. This I suppose called a segue what I'm about to do here, Seth. So pay attention.
Go.
Let's go make some noise by talking to Betsy in actually this fabulous city of Naperville, Illinois. Betsy, are you on the line?
I'm on Skype. Can you hear me?
I sure can, Betsy. You sound great. Well, what's your question for Seth or me or both?
This is the equivalent of the car phone calling into the radio show.
It is. I love them both. I'm so excited. This is really started out for Dan, but sure like to get your input too, Seth. I shared the RSA video on Drive with the cool graphics with my manager and director, and now they want me to talk to the department for a half an hour about it. And just wondered, if, you got me in hot water. Tepid water. Wondering if you have some recommendations and how to approach it and, you know, what are the salient pieces that I could use to bring out conversation about how to go about doing more drive-like things in the business.
Okay, let me offer some context for the listeners out there. There's a video out there on the interweb that has gotten a fair number of plays. That is basically a 9-minute distillation of a talk I gave a while back, and it's accompanied by this incredible guy named Andrew Park from Cognitive Media in the UK, who does a series of illustrations to bring out the ideas in a visual way. And so it takes my meager words and connected with his wonderful drawings, and it's gotten a lot of plays. Now, it's interesting that I like to think the video speaks for itself, and so I would, you know, I don't think we need to have a senior seminar in the semiotics of that video, but I do think what you could do, Betsy, are the following. What I've seen in talking about the issues of drive, particularly addressing some of managerial skepticism about autonomy, a lot of the pushback that you get, I'll hear people say, listen, I agree that these intrinsic forces matter more than these extrinsic forces. I agree that, you know, in general, people, you know, do better under conditions of autonomy. But, you know, I've got to deal with these people here. These people aren't like that. And so I think the question that I've found to help people really see the benefit of loosening the reins a little bit in the way that they run their organizations is this. It is a great conversation to have. The question is this. Tell me about the best boss you ever had. Tell me about the best boss you ever had, and have people talk about that. And what you inevitably hear when you ask people to describe the best boss they ever have are two things, at least in my experience, two things. Number one, high standards, and number two, autonomy. You very rarely hear somebody describe the best boss they ever had like this. Oh, the best boss I ever had, she was amazing. She breathed down my neck the whole time. She told me exactly what to do and how to do it. She was unbelievably controlling. What you hear is the language of autonomy and freedom along with high standards. And I think that's a good way to get folks, especially management folks, to think about how they operate their businesses and how they deal with people in a way that brings it closer to home. The other thing is, I mean, cite some of the examples of companies that are doing some really interesting things in the way of autonomy and delivering good results. My favorite idea out there, very simple, very easily acted on, is this idea of the FedEx Day, where started by a company called Atlassian, where people on a Thursday afternoon, they say to folks, hey, go work on anything you want. Do it the way you want. Do it with whomever you want. Do whatever you want. The only thing we ask is that you show what you've created to the rest of the company on Friday afternoon, 24 hours later. And it turns out that this one day of intense autonomy has led to a whole array of fixes for existing software, a whole array of ideas for new products that had otherwise never emerged. And so this is, in my mind, one of the best ideas out there. So I think to answer your question a little bit more precisely, Number one, get people thinking about their own experiences being managed and ask them about the best boss they ever had. And two, focus on the results of these more autonomy-centered practices, particularly something like FedEx Day. Does that make sense to you, Betsy?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me what kind of company you work at.
Credit card company.
Credit card company. All right.
And very high in the extrinsic rewards.
Sure.
We've got 10 reward programs, recognition programs.
Wow. I mean, there's nothing wrong with recognition per se. The question about because recognition is a form of feedback. It actually can be very helpful. The question, the problem is, and for those of you who've looked at this book, Drive, the problem is when it becomes contingent. If the only way, the only reason you're doing something is for the reward or for the recognition, then it can get ugly. Betsy, thanks for your call. Let's go to Scott in Reno. Scott in Reno, you're on the air.
Hey, Dan. Is this
Scott?
Yeah, how you doing? This is actually Derek. I got my phone from Scott. Anyway, hi.
Okay.
I think Seth knows me.
Does someone have actually there was a show called Reno 911, and I'm tempted to call that number right now because obviously Derek has stolen Scott's phone. Seth, do you have any? You get a lot of calls in Reno?
No, I actually moved there from New York and. I sent Seth an email a couple days ago, so I guess
Uh-oh.
He knows me now.
Close friends. That's permission marketing in action right there. Sending Seth.
Yeah, hey guys. You know, happy Passover or whatever.
What's your question?
I have a question for you. What? Hello?
Yeah, what's your question?
Okay, so I'm actually writing a paper about both of you guys for my MBA program, and I'm thinking
Is it UNLV where you're getting your pilot's license?
Yeah, no, actually I did that on my own, but yeah, I go to UNLV. And my question is for you guys, what do you think about the market growth share matrix? I think it doesn't work in this time. And I wanted to, if you guys had a couple words to say, I don't like it or I like it.
I'm going to see the market growth matrix question as an MBA. I have a law degree, so if we have anybody who wants to know about the Equal Protection Clause or substantive due process, Seth, what do you think about the market growth matrix?
I actually know what it is. I remember it from my MBA program, and I've written about it in some books years ago. Imagine an XY grid divided into four quadrants, and on one axis you have the size of the market from huge to tiny, and in the other axis you have the growth of the market from declining to growing fast. What it was invented for at the Boston Consulting Group, where it made their reputation, is this notion that if you have a portfolio of companies, the way someone like General Electric might, you want to make sure that they're not all in one quadrant, and you want to invest in a certain way. Each of the quadrants has a catchy name. A business that is a huge market that's not growing, called the cash cow, because it spews off money. There's no need to reinvest. A business that is small and not growing is called the dog. And there are two left, which is the star, and I forgot the fourth one. And the argument that BCG has is that you need to find a few businesses where the market is small but growing fast where you can invest. You need some cash cows to keep things moving, and then you can play beyond those realms. So if I look at AOL 10 years ago, AOL owned a cash cow. And the question is, what should AOL have done?
The cash cow of dial-up internet access.
Yeah, right, because it was huge. It was slowly going to shrink. There was no sense in investing in it. And it was spewing off hundreds of millions of dollars a month. What they should have done is taken that money and bought a little company called Google, and bought a little company called Facebook, and bought other fast-growing opportunities. And if they had done that today, AOL would still equal the Internet. But they didn't do that because they forgot to pay attention to the growth share matrix. So for an individual, for a small business person, it doesn't make any sense. For corporate boardrooms, I think it's essential understanding.
Okay, great. Great answer. We have some people on our high-tech control panel here at Thinking World Headquarters who are being signified by their company rather than by their name. So But there's a very intriguing one on the list here from Los Angeles. So I'm giving you time to look around and see whether you are in Los Angeles. And if you're in Los Angeles and your company initials are PP, you're on the air. Los Angeles, company initials PP.
Hey, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Tell us your first name.
Yeah, my name is Doug, and
Doug.
I want...
Welcome to Office Hours.
Yeah. Hey, guys, I'm not going to tell you PP, but let me just say that it's in the storytelling business. And
it's in the storytelling business, yes. You know
yeah.
what? Maybe we have a prize to who can guess where you work.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get fired, but it's a great company, actually. But
yeah.
my comment and my my observation is that the use of story, particularly with the Internet, has really changed how I communicate technical information, and that includes, you know, use of Snagit or open source software. And I just wanted to see if you guys, and Dan, you've written about this, the use of create a story to tell your position, to communicate a variety of things. And I find that it just really unlocks the door for people, and it blindsides them because they're used to just, you know, rote words. And my God, when I look at long emails now, my eyes glaze over. But when you give me a picture, and I can just grab it really fast. Are you seeing that that's more of a trend, and how effective is that in your experience?
Oh, I think it's well. Thanks for the great question. I think it's obviously hugely important. And, you know, I think we can put it in context as well. That is, you know, we live in a world of ubiquitous facts, right? So facts are everywhere and they're free. So something that is, you know, ubiquitous and free on its own isn't all that valuable. I think what matters more is putting facts in context, delivering them with emotional impact. So that's what stories do. And so you see story moving to a whole range of business functions when in the past it was dismissed as something light or something deceitful. And now it's becoming valuable because of the change in the architecture of the market itself. At the same time, human beings, you know, we don't see the world as a series of episodes all the time, or a series of logical propositions. We see it as a narrative. We see it as a series of episodes. So when people, you know, come back from a hard day at the office, they don't say to their spouse or their partner, ask them, hey, how was your day? You know, they don't say, oh, let me give you my 14-point PowerPoint deck, or let me show you how my growth matrix was affected today. They say, oh, you're not going to believe it. First this happened, then that happened, then that happened. They narrate. And so I think this fundamental capacity, which I think too often has been left at the office door, is being let in a way that I think is good for business and good for human beings. And I think there's a great strategic benefit in inviting in storytelling, particularly, and I'm going to hand it off to Seth here in a moment, particularly in a world where average doesn't cut it, unremarkable doesn't cut it, mediocre doesn't cut it, and what sort of, I think, can rescue certain kinds of offerings from mediocrity, can help make them remarkable, is the story that's embedded in that offering. Seth, what do you think about stories?
Well, I want to go further than that. I think that all there is stories.
All right.
And that facts are just a particularly lame storytelling technique.
Oh.
That there are certain people who that's the only story that works on them, but they're still telling themselves a story when they're using what they call facts. And if you talk to people who are, for example, brilliant at mathematics, something that most of us think of as dry fact-based stuff, they're not brilliant at it because they're good at facts. They're brilliant at it because numbers tell them a story. And that the mistake that businesses make is they depersonalize and de-riskify decision making by pretending they're dealing with facts. But they're not. They're telling themselves a story. And so, you know, we can denigrate a politician who's out of touch with reality because they believe in unicorns and all sorts of stuff that we know isn't true, but really what they're doing is trafficking in stories. And their competition, which may say that they are in the fact business, is actually just doing a pretty lame job of telling a story that's more important.
Excellent point. The other thing that I think that's interesting is how much this has, in terms of the marketing, particularly of product, how much story, explicit story, not numbers as a variation of stories, but explicit stories have become the differentiator in certain kinds of product categories. So if you look at something like food, I mean, walk into Whole Foods, and you're basically walking into a giant collection of stores. You can literally see the photograph of the guy who milks the cow that's in the milk container where you are. You can hear the backstory of how your rutabaga got to the market. And so I think there's something really powerful about that. But what I keep coming back to is the humanity of it, in the sense that a lot of times in business, we sort of come up with this affect of this is how it is to talk in business. And we talk in business in the way that we never talk to our friends or to our spouse or to our children. And story is a way to, I think, naturalize that kind of language. We've got an educator, someone from a school district. But again, I have the, that's what it's saying on our elite control panel here at Thinking World Headquarters in our glass enclosed nerve center here. I'm going to Chesterfield, Missouri, an educator, I think, in Chesterfield, Missouri. Chesterfield, are you there?
Would that be me?
I guess it would be.
All right, fantastic.
Tell us your first name and your question.
My name is Paul.
Paul, hi, Paul. Welcome to Office Hours.
Fantastic. This is to you, Dan. I read Drive for my doctorate coursework. I work on my dissertation focusing on student self-motivation.
Okay.
And the question I have here is at my school, as an assistant principal, we are trying to we went cold turkey this year, getting rid of all extrinsic motivators. No pencils, no treats, nothing along those lines, no flipping cards for behavior, just really focused on the intrinsic form of motivating the kids to do what's right. However, our challenge has been and still continues to be, we don't have everybody on board. We have teachers that have been teaching, you know, anywhere from 5 to 25 years that are not quite on board with this method of teaching. What would you suggest moving forward to get everybody on board? I mean, they understand the concept of intrinsic motivation and value of it, but changing their teaching methods to incorporate that.
I think it's a hard one, and I think that for folks like that, they need to have some scaffolding, oftentimes, so that you can't simply say, you know, you've been relying on giving people candy for good behavior for 20 years, and you know, tomorrow I want you to begin surfacing all of these intrinsic drives that your students have. I think you need to maybe start in a more modest way. Have you tried anything like that? I mean, when you say you went cold turkey, that sort of concerned me a little bit, because a lot of times those cold turkey approaches don't work so well with ingrained behavior. They foster a kind of resistance.
With cold turkey, as far as kids would receive a pencil for coming down and doing the announcements, just different things like that. We do understand that there's, you know, 5 to 10% of kids who do need that intrinsic motivation in order to do well. When we give the teachers the flexibility and, you know, the decision to make that determination of who really does need it and who doesn't. So I wouldn't say, you know, 100%, it's all gone. That would be a false statement, I guess.
Yeah.
Dan, can I squeeze in here for a second?
Come in.
I think this goes right back to the thing we were just talking about with storytelling. First of all, if teachers are pushing back, it's because they don't believe the story you're telling them. And that story is complicated. It's about failure. It's about risk. It's about peace of mind. If that story isn't vivid enough, well, then I'm not surprised they don't want to take action. And part of your job is to find success stories, amplify them, repeat them, create a folklore around them so the teachers will choose to adopt the methods you used to be able to tell those stories. And the second thing I want to say is there's a really big difference between intrinsic motivation and choosing not to use external tools to amplify intrinsic motivation. One of my favorite tools, which my friend Zig taught me years ago and which I used when I ran a summer camp in Canada, is I printed up a whole stack of Post-its that were 2 inches square, and printed on each one it said, I like, and then there was a blank, and it said, because. And what I did to manage a staff of 90 teenagers who were, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, every time I caught them doing something right, I wrote their name, and I wrote what they had done right, and I just handed them the slip. No fanfare, no public anything. Mm-hmm. And what happened within a couple days is you started noticing these little slips on their clipboards, on the walls of their cabin, hanging around. And within 4 days, the most incorrigible, hard-case teenagers who were unmotivatable started saying things to me like, what do I need to do to get one of those? And I wasn't giving them a lollipop. What I was doing was reminding them of how it felt to be happy with themselves.
Okay. We have a system very similar to that. It is a fantastic – we do – that has been incorporated into our plans this year. It's kind of a caught being good in a sense of them doing the right thing and being acknowledged in a private manner.
Yeah, and the key to that, I mean, I think that there's some elements of that, of the Seth Post-it plan that are mm-hmm. brilliant. But I think it's a delicate substance. So, you know, what the research shows pretty clearly for those kinds of things to work effectively is that what those counselors are getting is a form of feedback. And in many cases, in many workplaces, people are absolutely deprived of feedback. And I think that's true for teachers as well. And so those slips operate as a form of feedback. And the fact that they are private is really powerful, too, because it's not a kind of big celebration. It's not an awards dinner or anything like that. It's actually taken, I think, more seriously in that way. The only thing that would concern me about that approach is if it becomes a contingency. If people are acting well, acting in noble ways in order to get the pat on the back from an authority figure. If it becomes contingent, it can be kind of toxic. But as a form of feedback, I think that it's great. And I think that, you know, that makes a very good point in general about related to your situation, which is teachers just don't get any feedback. I mean, especially now when teachers are being demonized and vilified for being the problem in the education system. And I think that, you know, teachers getting feedback in the form of celebrating their successes and their success stories, et cetera, things, can be really, really powerful. The other thing that comes out is the power of, in general, of small wins in celebrating those. And so if you take, using Seth's example, maybe this method has made one particularly incorrigible kid behave a little bit better and understand why it's important to behave better. If you start spreading those kinds of stories and assess that those become part of the folklore, then I think you have a really fighting chance. But I think in general, I'm delighted that your school district is moving away from these carrot and stick, let's treat kids like donkey approaches. I think, unfortunately, much of the rest of the education system is going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so, we definitely have implemented the got rid of the if-then to the now-what method. I've used that several times with you know, private conversations with teachers, you know, with their feedback, with my feedback toward them. So they definitely
Seth and Zig's approach is very much a now that reward, rather than an if then reward. It's not if you do something great, I'll give you a slip. It's basically saying, now that you've done something great, here's a slip. And there's a subtle difference between the two.
I agree.
But the fact that it's feedback is great. And also, I mean, Seth said a nice phrase about, you know, people, or maybe it was you, people caught doing something well. There's another technique in there, very much out there, in the form of a now that reward that some companies are doing. That seems a little extrinsic, and it is extrinsic in a way, but it's non-contingent. Where inside of a firm, and I don't think I want to do this in schools, but inside of say a private company, at any moment, anybody in the company can give someone in there, one of their colleagues, one of their coworkers, on the spot a $50 bonus. And what the effect that has had is really kind of interesting, because what it has done is it has opened people's eyes to the fact that other folks in their midst are doing some good things. And it sort of changed the psychological atmosphere of the place, because people are now looking for other people who are doing great things. And so I think that those kinds of things can change. Again, I really like the way Seth put it. It can change sort of the folklore about a place. So thanks for your question, and thanks for being an educator. I think that this vilification of teachers and principals that's going on right now is offensive. So I think most teachers, most principals are heroes. So thanks for being a hero.
I have something I've been meaning to talk to you about, which is a little controversial.
One thing
I am discovering is that thanks to 80 years of brainwashing, a lot of employees prefer extrinsic motivation. that given the choice between a boss who breathes down their neck, pushes them hard, tells them what to do, and gives them deniability and a good paycheck, or a boss who gives them a platform, freedom, and the ability to fail, a lot of people will pick the former because we've spent so many years training them that that's what they should do.
I don't disagree with you. I think that what you're, that behavior you're describing there is very much learned behavior. I don't think it's our natural state. In one of your books, Seth, I'm glad you mentioned this, in one of your books, you have an anecdote of, and again, it's showing how stories stick, you have an anecdote of sitting on an airplane next to a 2-year-old. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And it's this kid who is just like active and engaged and curious about the world. And I think one of the things that you say is, when was the last time you were like that? And what I have seen is that kind of behavior that you're describing inside of organizations is prevalent. But I'm convinced it's learned behavior. It's not our natural state. I think our natural state is to be active and engaged and curious. I've never seen a 2-year-old, as you said, who's not that way. I've never seen a 4-year-old who's not that way. And I think that it's very difficult if you've learned behavior over 20 years or 40 years or 60 years to undo that in the snap of a finger. So if you think about these groovy things like 10% time that Intuit does or 20% time that Google does, where people can spend 20% of the time, 10% of the time doing whatever they want. If you've got a guy named Fred who's at your organization and Fred's been doing the same thing pretty much the same way for 20 years, you can't go into Fred tomorrow and say, hey, Fred, guess what? You know, 20% time, baby, let's roll. I mean, Fred's going to wig out. And so I think that one of the challenges out there is how do you provide scaffolding to get people from that learned behavior, which I think you and I would agree is deleterious, to this other state that we think is more valuable, but that isn't quite an off-on switch for people. What are the steps in between? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, right. And so the reason I'm bringing it up is a lot of the people who read your blog and are on this call are the enlightened ones, and they're going to go try this stuff in their work, and it's not going to work right away. And instead of getting a standing ovation, they're going to get disappointing results and funny looks because the scaffolding is so critical.
Yeah.
And so the reason I'm bringing it up is not because I know the simple 5-step process, but because I'm saying you need to go in with your eyes open and saying, this is scary for you and scary for the people you lead. And you need to go in knowing that it's going to take months before you start seeing the stuff that makes it worth the effort.
I agree with you, and I think that you also have to be, and if you look at the birth, it's so interesting, if you look at the birth of how some of these innovations have happened, they've happened by people with a little bit more moxie, a little bit more courage, who've been willing to withstand that. And it does take courage to do these kinds of things. It's people who have been, in their own way, strategically subversive. And I guess, you know, drawing on some of what you've written about, I guess you have a choice. You can be strategically subversive and deal with the fallout, or you can just keep marching along. And I think that we have to rely on the strategic subversives out there and encourage them as much as possible, but also be realistic about how quickly you can change things. And a lot of times I think we ask the wrong question. We look at our organizations and say, hey, can I change everything? And the answer is no, you can't. Can I change everyone? No, you can't. I think the real question is, can you do one small thing to move things forward a little bit? And I think in most cases we can. Let's go to Raj in Grand Prairie, Texas. Raj, you're on the air on Office Hours.
Yes, thank you, Dan and Seth. This is Raj in Dallas, actually. The phone just says Grand Prairie, which is a suburb here. Glad to be on. I'd like to ask both of you how you guys would describe meaning in your life. You know, this is taking on Dan's book about the six senses for the new world. How do you describe finding meaning in your life? And I'll take the call off the air.
All right. I thank you for respecting talk radio conventions, Raj, by taking the call off the air. Seth, talk to us about meaning.
Oh, boy. You know, I think that all of us set out with the same sort of agenda. We just execute what we're measuring differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, as an entrepreneur in 1987 who was almost bankrupt and was window shopping in restaurants and eating SpaghettiOs for dinner. Meaning meant not giving up on my dream of being able to self-determine. And then in the 90s, when you start building a family or you have a different kind of organization, you look for a different sort of meaning in your life in terms of the symptoms. But I think at its core, what it comes down to for me is doing work that matters, being missed if I'm not there, and realizing that I did something that was probably a little more difficult than I had any right to do. And I think if I can do those three things, it was a good day, it was a good month. And I keep pushing myself to make the arc longer. I'm willing to be uncomfortable for an hour or afraid for a week if it ends up a month from now or 6 months from now or a year from now, looking back being, yeah, I'm glad I put myself through that.
Fantastic. We have a question sort of related to this, Seth, for you that came in from we got a lot of we have so many people with their hands up. I'm delighted about that. We have well in excess of the calls that we could possibly take in the next 8 minutes. I mean, just orders of magnitude more. We also have a lot of questions coming in via the magic of the interwebs here. But we have a really interesting question for you, Seth, from Nathan in La Sueur, Minnesota. I guess that's the French-speaking part of Minnesota. He said, Seth, who do you rely on for good advice? I mean, in my view, Seth is one of the all-time great advice givers. I mean, I read his blog, the email. I'm serious, man. Every morning, so as part of my daily ritual, it's like, well, what does Godin have to say? After I get past the irritation that he's able to write something every day, I actually read the advice. But I'm curious. I think it's a great question from Nathan in La Sueur, Minnesota. Where do you go for advice?
Okay. Well, there are a number of people whose writing shines a light for me and opens doors. And you can go all the way back to Dan's first book, which I blurbed, I believe, sitting right over there. I can see it on the wall to know that he is high on that list. That people back from the day, like Zig Ziglar, or currently like Hugh MacLeod, or Pam Slim, or Jackie Huba, say things that resonate with me. But I really got to say that looking over my shoulder, in my head all the time, is my mom, who died 9 years ago. And I hear her voice all the time. And if I can do something that I think she's going to be proud of, it's a good day.
Fantastic. And I noticed that Poke the Box is dedicated to her, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's true.
Yes. There you go. Fantastic. All right. Let's see here. Let's expand the geography. We have someone who is designated only. Okay, we got. Let's not do that. We got a lot of people from Illinois. What's going on here? Let's go to. We have somebody who I see from Phoenix, Arizona. If you're from, we don't have a name. We have Phoenix, Arizona, who is calling from a wireless device. So let's roll the dice here and talk to Phoenix, Arizona, from a wireless device. Phoenix, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. It's Sandy.
Tell me your first name, Sandy. Sandy, welcome to Office Hours with Seth Godin. What's your call all the way from Phoenix?
Yeah, and I'm just calling because I'm dealing right now with the transactional environment of the Internet and social media. And as you know, left a large company and created 426, which is a not-for-profit, and we're working with some standards organizations and all. And what we're really trying to do is figure out that sort of trifecta around old and new ways, but this whole human interaction that's going on that feels like the Internet is really a giant vending machine. And I wondered how you guys deal with that.
It's only a giant vending machine for everyone. It's not necessarily a giant vending machine for the people you care about.
Yeah.
And that's the key distinction. The key distinction is it used to be that strangers, disinterested parties, and passersby were invisible to you. They didn't walk into your shop. They didn't call you on the phone. But now they're all exposed. And so there's this weird envy of there's always one more person or 1,000 more people to friend me, follow me, give me feedback. And as Charlie the Unicorn says, you must shun the non-believers. And if they can't take a, if they can't take a joke, walk away. It is way, way more important to have 2,000 true fans who are not there in a vending machine model than it is to have 30,000 fans with guns pointing at your boots saying, dance, fool, dance.
And so how about the leadership piece of that? I mean, this is the part where we're trying to get those people that actually do develop those long-term relationships. And, you know, it's a mix of both of your books, honestly. What do you do with the leadership piece? How do you pull those leaders of those tribes out, Seth, and get them to, you know, work together, given they only have 8 minutes in every day?
Well, but they have more than 8 minutes for what matters to them. Have you ever been able to get any of them to pay attention and interact with you and learn and grow?
Absolutely. But again, it's very, very small snippets, and trying to weave the whole big story together, I think, is, you know, in an operational sense, and trying to pull that together for our end goals is where we're struggling. And everyone in this group that we work with, they're entrepreneurial, they're motivated, lots of intrinsic motivation, and they really have desire. And we're all, you know, various kinds of technology being used. We're using all the new models. You know, we're totally virtual. None of us ever see each other physically, ever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way we run Squidoo. There's only six of us, and we're the 88th biggest website in the United States, and we don't live in the same state. The challenge is, the hard part for us was realizing that 1% of the world was more than we could ever handle. And so what I'm pushing back on you on is, my guess is that you're measuring the size of the waves, the ripples that are going across the universe, as opposed to how many people would actually be distraught if your organization disappeared. And, you know, how do you make it so that you only add one or two or three people an hour to the circle of people who really count? Because at the end of the year, that's 8,000 people. That's a lot. That's enough to change the world. But you won't get to 8,000 people if you try to do it all at once. It's about obsessive focus, peeling people off, rejecting the people who aren't going to make you better, and focusing on standing for something, which means being opposed to other things.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the question. We got time for, I think, one more here, Seth. Let me go to the high-tech control panel here in the Glass and Closed Nerve Center and find, let's see here, how about Camarillo, California, if you're there. Camarillo, California.
Yes, hi, this is Scott.
Hey, Scott.
How's it going? I'm also a school leader, director of a special education school that has a whole school of those encourageables, I guess.
Fantastic. And, thanks for doing that.
Yeah. So I have actually two questions. One would be, you know, if you're running a school like ours, we have a non-public school is one of our official titles, which allows us to break the mold of public schools. So if you could run a school like ours, what is one or two of the things looking forward that if you could break into a school and say, this is what you need to be doing, what would that be? And then secondly, is as we're introducing Drive and some of the pieces that we're getting big on, is when you're, I'm really looking at how we hire people and how you find the people that have that intrinsic motivation, that desire for change, that innovation. What kind of questions do you ask when you're looking to hire those kind of people? How do you get into that in an interview?
Yeah, these are two tough questions, and I'll give Seth the final word on this. On, you know, if you could wave a magic wand, start from scratch on the school you're talking about, I think I'd do a few things. Number one is I would give, I was going to say hire great people. We'll get to that in a moment. But I would give the teachers much greater autonomy over what goes on in the classroom. One of the really distressing things about American public education today is that we're turning teachers into automatons, telling them what to teach, how to teach it, when to teach it. And I think that's going to drive a lot of great people out of the profession, and it's going to prevent the kind of individualized learning that you need, especially in something like special education. So give teachers much greater autonomy. And the other thing is, I think we do a terrible job generally of explaining to kids why we're doing what we're doing. We just tell them to do stuff. Do your homework. And when they ask, why are we doing this in the first place, we say, be quiet and do your homework. And I think that giving kids a sense of the why, how does it fit in, is really powerful. I did this panel discussion a few weeks ago. And, of course, here in Washington, D.C., as David Brooks has said, whoever is on the most panel discussion wins. And there was a young woman, 16-year-old student, who said, I said, do you have any suggestions for all the educators in the audience? There were 700 educators in the audience. And she said, well, and she was very sheepish. She was very reserved. She said, well, how about if before we start a lesson or before we start a unit, we explain people, the teachers explain to us why we're studying this, how it fits into what we studied before, and maybe what kind of things in the real world connect to it. And I think every educator in there was kind of shrinking into their seat saying, God, why are we not doing that? So on the first question, autonomy for teachers and why for students. On hiring, I think it's really tough. I mean, I don't think anyone has cracked the nut in schools or elsewhere on how to hire great people. I think that part of it is you look at what people have done. Look at what people have done. Not what they say, but what they've actually done with their lives. And especially if you see people who have zigged when everybody else is zagging and talk about it in a way that isn't defensive but is proud. So people who have actually done stuff, used the steps, parlance, people who have shipped, and people who have taken an alternate path, and when you ask them about it, celebrate it rather than shrink from it. So what, any thoughts on this as we wrap up here?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're going to be doing such important work, you might as well do it in a way that could change everything. And the way I would change everything in the first part is I would organize a school designed to create charismatic leaders who make good decisions. And any topic that is taught that has nothing to do with being a charismatic leader or making good decisions should be jettisoned. Don't teach anything that doesn't move that forward. Memorizing stuff does not help you. Understanding conjugation, unless it helps you sell your decisions, does not help you. And if you were actually successful at churning out these people who know how to find people who have memorized facts, you would have done a great service. So I know that's scary and will probably be compromised away, but that's what I would like to see schools do. And as for the second notion, what I've learned about hiring is this. If you can hire people you have already worked with, you will almost never make a hiring mistake. And so I would organize the whole thing around making it easy for people to part-time or freelance for you on weekends to actually get compensated for doing a version of the work you want them to do all the time. And then from that pool of people, take no risk. Just find people who have already done the job right before your eyes in a way that blows you away.
Great advice, Seth, as always. So we're at the end of the hour here on our premiere episode of Office Hours. We hope that the hundreds of callers we had, hundreds of listeners we had in from all over the world enjoyed it. Apologies to the dozens and dozens of people whose questions we didn't get to. And most of all, thanks to Seth Godin, whose blog, SethGodin.com, is must-reading. And if you're like me, you read it every day by email. Seth, thanks for the inspiration, the insight, and the advice today. It's been a pleasure having you on the premiere episode of Office Hours.
You know, it's something I'll treasure, a memory that I'll have for years. And I thank you for it, Mr. Pink. O-H!
I-O, for those of you who are from Central Ohio. So, again, let's wrap up here. Thanks to everybody for joining us here on Office Hours, our premiere broadcast, our maiden voyage. Stay tuned for more episodes with more great guests coming up later this spring. Thanks, everybody.